Thank you very much, Sue, and good morning. It is great to be here, and as Sue mentioned, you know, I grew up in this industry, and I've seen a lot of changes over the last 45 years in terms of how the industry is structured. And when I asked Sue how long I had this morning, she said, oh, about 30 minutes. You know, to an ag economist, that's a daunting task. We can't even get through our assumptions in less than 15 minutes. So in the next 29 minutes and 36 seconds, Gary, hopefully we can work our way through this and talk about some of the changes, particularly in the tree industry, that have been rather monumental. So without further ado, let's always start talks with a big quote. And I love this quote by Alvin Toffler. It says, you got to think about the big things while you're doing the small things, so the small things go in the right direction. And many companies in our industry, the green industry, have been very adept at growing high-quality plants because of many of you in this room. However, we saw the paradigm shift dramatically with the Great Recession. And that recession really did change things noticeably. And in responding to the Great Recession, many of the firms that found themselves still in business found that they had a new paradigm in which to address, a new consumer mindset, if you will, and therefore the need for a new value proposition. And so I'm going to be talking from that perspective this morning. Now, in many of my talks, I start out with this slide. I love starting with the slide and then watching the eyes of the audience as I flash up this slide, because it violates every PowerPoint norm that's known to man. But I don't expect you to read anything on this slide. I'm demonstrating the complexity of the green industry supply chain. And though my comments are directly pertaining to the green industry, many of the other horticultural sectors, including the fruits and veggies and nut crops, etc., would fall into some of the things I'm going to be talking about. So you see on the right-hand side of this slide some key words there that identify some of the structural changes in our industry. Now, as Sue mentioned, growing up in business, this was in the 70s when my folks first started the business, and we were trying to grow our operation when Reagan took office in 1980. And the industry was growing at almost 14% every year, 13.86% every year. And it didn't take a lot of business acumen to make a lot of money in the green industry. And in fact, we as a family business, we made money in spite of ourselves. I look back at some of the things we did and I just shake my head. You know, what were we thinking? And we really didn't grow that good a plant, but there weren't that many plants around. So we were making money in spite of ourselves. And then, of course, the industry growth slowed down in the 80s. Going into the 90s, it slowed down to 9.6%, and by the time the 90s finished up, Fred, we were 6.5%. And then going into the early 2000s, that growth rate continued to decline. By the time the first decade of the 2000s closed, we were at basically flat. Now, in economic terms, we call that in the mature stage of the industry life cycle, and every product in every industry goes through an infancy stage and a growth phase and a maturity stage, and it's at that point that it's a very pivotal moment in the life of an industry, because they can either continue doing the same things that they've been doing and hoping for different results, or they need to reinvent themselves in some way. And in many ways, I think the horticultural industry is at that juncture. And there's an old phrase that if you always do what you've always done, you're always going to get what you've always gotten. And I think as professional horticulturists in this room, we've got to think about different ways of presenting, maybe not our work, but how our work is construed by our end users, our constituents, if you will. Because in many cases in the green industry, we've been living under the guise that we make landscapes pretty, or we make interiorscapes pretty. Well, we're going to need something a little more better in the future, because pretty is not a value proposition that's really going to cut it anymore. So, I'm going to talk about some cross-cutting challenges, if you will. We know that the industry is maturing. We know that it's very hyper-competitive, meaning that the competitive advantages that have gotten firms to where they are today are not the same competitive advantages that are going to carry them into the future. And there's some cross-cutting challenges that we're going to have to address that, as you look at this list, it should be no surprise, with the exception of perhaps one of them. And let's just talk about water, for instance. Now water, and this is the most recent drought map, and we know that things are very dire in the West, as I understand, I didn't make it to the climate workshop yesterday, but the climate change workshop was a very a good one. And the basic outcome of that, from those who attended and my talking with them, was that there are some things that we can do from an anthropogenic standpoint to mitigate some of the effects of climate change. But the wheels are in motion, and so we're going to have to perhaps change some of the ways in which we are addressing climate change currently. But when it comes down to it, when it comes to the watering people or watering plants, who's going to win that particular battle? People, right? And we see that in California. It's the mecca, it's the horticultural paradise of our country, and yet we're seeing the water in its scarcity in California being allocated to people more so to plants, even high-valued crops, almonds, etc., are having difficulty in getting the water that they need. So that's going to continue to be an issue across the country. And many other of our associations recognize that the outdoor use of water, and if you look at the pie here, you can see that if you look externally, the urban use of water and then the municipal use of water outdoors is fairly significant, and thus the issue. And other associations, like one of our sister associations, like the Irrigation Association, has a very interesting quote regarding their policy stance regarding water. And it's highlighted here, and you can't read that, so I'll read it for you. It says, the recognized benefits of cultivated and maintained landscapes, including oxygen creation, carbon sequestration, heat reduction, water retention, noise abatement, and dust control, among others, should be taken into consideration during policy development. And notice it didn't say anything about those landscapes being pretty, but it's all about the ecosystem services benefits that those landscapes provide. And I'll come back to that here in a little bit. But that's a very good indicator that we as an industry need to be mindful of how our end users view our products and services. And so we need to always be thinking about how they construe from a value standpoint and from a relevancy standpoint. Because as you'll soon see, people afford the things that they want. Now, labor. I could show you a labor chart upon labor chart. Believe me, I have a number of them that I could show you to show that the labor market is improving, and that the unemployment rate's going down, et cetera. We're creating more jobs in this country than we're losing currently up until 2018, when the next recession is predicted. You heard it here first, 2018. And so, in spite of that, though, when you talk to horticultural businesses around the country and you ask them what are they dealing with right now, what's the number one answer they tell you? Finding enough skilled labor, in spite of the fact that unemployment's going down. Why is that? Well, why was it during the Great Recession we didn't have a lot of difficulty in finding labor? It's because we had 465,000 construction jobs. When people lost those jobs, they came over to our industry. And so we actually benefited and got a reprieve from the labor scarcity during the Great Recession. And now that the economic state of the country is improving, albeit glacially, we see more pressure and more demand for those skilled laborers, and therefore we're finding it more difficult to attract them in horticulture. Why? Well, if you compare our wage levels compared to other industries, how do we compare? Well, not so favorably. Well, why are our wages, Mary, not higher than what they currently are for our horticultural graduates and even front-level unskilled horticultural laborers? Why aren't those wage rates higher? Well, it's got something to do with how the end consumer values our products and services and the prices in which we're receiving, and so we don't filter that back down to a higher wage for our workforce. So it all has to do with value and how we are construed as an industry. Now, obviously, we're making some effort as an association to try to change the mindset of people early on regarding horticulture and to make them more aware. And so our Seed Your Future program, we're in the midst of trying to figure that and to crack that proverbial nut. Now let's talk about the economy, all right, very quickly, and I won't get carried away because I could very easily talk for the rest of the 18 minutes and 13 seconds just on this topic, but I want to give it to you in a nutshell. And I'm always asked when I go to speak about the economy, Charlie, your 4,613 slides are really nice, but if we could just look at one number, one economic number, what would that be? And I always refer back to the movie City Slickers. Remember Billy Crystal asking Jack Palance the secret to life? And he says, it's one thing. Well, this is the one thing economically that you should know. And I'm going to pause for a dramatic effect here. The one number that you should follow if you want to see how the economy is going to be doing over the next 9 to 12 months. It's called the Leading Economic Index as developed by the Conference Board, and that's this particular chart right here. And you can see if you follow the mouse arrow, how it precipitously declined during the recession, and then that Leading Economic Index has been gradually improving since the recession to the recovery began in June 2009. Now, that particular index is really a comogulation of about 10 different... Hey, I think I just made up a word. Sometimes it just comes out. It's just, wow, okay. This comogulation of about 10 indicators all rolled into one. You got interest rates and jobs and the housing market, etc. And that's why I like it, because it has these indicators rolled into one number, and it... As the trend, let me look at my laser here. As this goes up, all right, as you see it going up, that's a signal of how the economy is going to be doing over the next 9 to 12 months. So you can see we really don't have much to worry about in terms of any red flags for the rest of 2015 and 2016, as I just said a while ago, all the way up to about 2018. So that's good news, right? We don't really have an impediment in terms of the economy. If you look at housing, of course, the horticultural sector is very correlated with housing. And as housing goes, so does the green industry. And you can see how the housing starts fell precipitously during the recession. And then you can see the dead cat bouncing on the bottom. Now, that's a real term that we economists use. It's a dead cat bouncing on the bottom. You take a cat at the top of the hotel and you drop it. How high does it bounce? About that far, right there. A lady in Wisconsin, she was a cat lover, and she took me to task for that little comment. But that's how we describe it. It's the dead cat bouncing on the bottom. And you can see since then, you know, follow the mouse, we've had increasing starts, and we're forecast about 1.5 million housing starts by 2018. We're roughly right now about 1.2. Now remember, before the recession started, we were at 2 million housing starts, and that's because we were trying to get folks into a house. It was the American dream. And every administration since LBJ has been fostering a fiscal and monetary policy to put Americans into houses. Because that was the American dream. Well, that American dream came back to bite us in the proverbial rear, And so we know now that we should not foster that, but grow the housing industry cautiously. And that's what's been happening. And so we're about 1.2 million housing starts. Natural levels of housing should be about 1.5. If you follow the demographics of the country, we should be building about 1.5 million housing starts. So we should be right about that level when the next recession starts. And by the way, recessions are not a thing to be feared. They're a natural part of business cycles. It's just that we as Americans are spoiled. We're Lake Wobegonians. We're all the men are good looking and the women are strong and the children above average and our stock market portfolios are ever increasing. And we like living in Lake Wobegon, but that's not realistic. Whenever you have growth, when in an economy, you have overvalued assets. And those overvalued assets need to be corrected. Otherwise, we'll go into a period of hyperinflation. And we saw that in Colombia and other South American countries, Fred, over the last decade. And that's disastrous for an economy. So that's part of the Federal Reserve's mission is to monitor all that and to make sure that those recessions don't really hit us too hard, but that we can manage our way through that. The good news is that all of our balance sheets and every business, horticultural business, has a balance sheet and an income statement. We as households, our individual households represented here, we too have a balance sheet. The assets minus liabilities, and our situations have been improving since the Great Recession, and that's good news because now we have more money to spend, and we're also feeling better. And this is the Consumer Confidence Index, and there's really two of them, one by the developed by the University of Michigan and one by the Conference Board, and you hear the media all the time. Consumer confidence is down 4.2%. Retail sales projected to be down. Well, I won't go so far to say that this particular economic indicator is useless, but I will say this. This particular economic indicator is totally useless. Don't pay attention to it. It doesn't matter how we feel. Again, I said we're very fickle as Americans, and we're a soundbite country. We vote by sound bites and we feel by sound bites. And you can see how we jump around. If we felt bad during the recession, then we felt better, then we didn't, then we didn't, then we good. It depends on what the media is telling us. And I always tell horticultural businesses across the country, do not let the media shape your strategic mindset. People make money in the midst of recessions. Again, it's a matter of how you're positioned in the marketplace and how people view you. So it's not about how we feel. It's about how we spend our money. And this next chart is about how we spend our money. This is personal consumption expenditures. This is the same data that you see that's one-fourth of GDP. Again, you got consumer expenditures, exports, business investment, and also government expenditures. That's the four major components of GDP. And personal consumption expenditures just happens to be about 70% of GDP. So we're a big part of recoveries because as we spend our dollars, those multipliers then create economic activity. But whenever Tabasco and other companies invest a dollar, guess what? We get a 4-to-1 return for every $1 that you all invest. But when we spend our consumer dollars, we only get a 2-to-1 return. So business investment tied to consumer expenditures is really the driving force there in terms of economic recovery. Now look at this chart very closely. This is where we were spending prior to the recession. Right? That's where we were spending. And this is where we're spending now. This is what we're spending now. All right? Then, now. Then, now. What's true about now? We're spending more today than what we did prior to the Great Recession, the single greatest economic downturn our country had seen in the last 80 years. Have we seen the sales of flower shrubs and trees increase at that same rate? Are people spending this on flower shrubs and trees compared to that? No. And yet we're spending more in total dollars. So what's happened? People have shifted expenditures away from what we offer. Well, why is that? It's because we only tell them that they're pretty. And that pretty doesn't cut it anymore. There's a higher value proposition. Now, there's a colleague of mine, Lowell Catlett, who is the dean at New Mexico State, and he gave the same talk, I bet you, 500 times. And the basic premise of his talk was people afford the things that they want. People afford the things that they want. Now, I've got this new iPhone 6 Plus and everything. Before that, I had the 5S. And I bought this, again, in the wake of the single greatest economic downturn in our country's history. Now, why did I buy this? Well, first of all, I wanted to be cool. Right? I needed a phone, but I needed, it's this symbolic value associated with having this. But I somehow found a way to buy this in the wake of the single greatest economic downturn. People afford the things that they want. It's just they haven't wanted flowers, shrubs, and trees in that same manner. Now, let's talk about why that is, and that's the lack of consumer interest. These two percentages right here, the 42% and 25%. 42% represents the number of people who have ever purchased a flower, shrub, tree, turf grass, any green industry product. That's the number of people. Total, ever. 42%. That's the highest that percentage has ever been. The 25% is the number of people that have purchased landscape services. So you see, we have tremendous upside potential, and we have the ability to capture some mind share if we position ourselves correctly. Now, the premise: people afford the things that they want. Right? This chart right here that's overlaid behind the picture or on top of the picture is what we spend on pets. What we spend on pets, and I have the picture in there for a reason because everybody knows as a speaker, if you want really high evaluations on your talk, you have pictures of kids and puppy dogs and ice cream, preferably. So I have the trifecta in this slide right here, right? The trifecta. But this is what we're spending on pets, right? Going all the way back to 1994. So we're rocking right along. We're spending more on our cats and dogs, and in Texas, our rattlesnakes and armadillos, and we're spending more on pets. And then the Great Recession hits, and it falls apart, right? It falls apart. My hands really aren't shaking that much, but it's just the direction. And then everything falls apart with the Great Recession. We see things go really bad during the Great Recession in 2008, and really bad again in 2009, 10, and 11. It's just really going to heck in a handbasket here. And then 2014 numbers are up there. Again, we have to ask ourselves, have the sales of horticultural products exhibited that same pattern? No. And why do we spend so much on our pets, but not so much on flowers, shrubs, trees, turf grass, and so forth? It's because of how they make us feel. It's because they are a necessity in our lives, and we view them as necessities versus luxuries. And for far too long, we've been considered to be a luxury item in people's lives rather than a necessity. Now, in my household, Tabasco is a necessity, right? It's not even an option, right? And hopefully the sales of Tabasco have followed that same trend. But we need to change that mindset. And now the good news is that I took some of this data and hired a PhD student to do an econometric model and forecast what the demand for plants was going to be between now and 2019. And you can see that by the end of 2019, we're going to be roughly here, which is roughly where we were right before the recession started. So we've got a ways to catch up, but the good news is that if we follow the same trends we have been over recent years, then we should be able to catch up. All right. Now, how will we be able to capture mind share of our consumer in the future? Well, Elizabeth, it's not about making landscapes pretty. It's not about making interiorscapes pretty. It's about emphasizing the economic benefits and the environmental ecosystem services benefits and the health and well-being benefits. And because if we look demographically, again, we know that these are boomers over here, right? This is the silent generation and the GI generation. This is all folks' population by age in the country. This is boomers right here. Boomers built the green industry because over half of the boomers have purchased flower shrubs and trees. And then this is Gen Y right here. Gen X, 47%. And we can see that the younger Gen Xers, only 38% have bought our products. And then here's Gen Y. So we got Gen X right here. That's 11 million fewer people. So over the next decade and a half, we can see that the overall demand for our products and services will decrease, if only by mathematics, because there's fewer people building houses, fewer people installing flower shrubs and trees around those houses. However, we've got to sell more product to the existing consumers and then convince Gen Y here to buy more flowers, shrubs, and trees when they get to the age of where they're going to be landscaping and so forth. Now, there's a lot of them. There's 84 million Gen Yers compared to 78 million boomers. So when they come on, when they're in the stage of life that they're landscaping, we're going to be back to Lake Wobegon again, just by sheer mathematics. But we got to get through the next decade and a half. But we can't forget about boomers just yet, because these older citizens right here, they're about 68 years of age and older. An average age of life expectancy is 78.9 years of age. And they control about $7 trillion worth of wealth, which means that over the next decade, we're going to see the single greatest transfer of wealth our country has ever seen in its history. And that $7 trillion worth of wealth, where's it going to go? Well, 50% of it's going to government, right, because of the estate planning law changes. Where's the other half going to go? Primarily to boomers, and then some extras and some wires, but primarily to boomers. And what have we baby boomers done with any wealth we've ever obtained? We have spent it. Absolutely. Our kids are going to have to get it themselves. We've spent it. And I said, the boomers put us on the map as an industry. So they've drunk the Kool-Aid. They know the value of flower shrubs and trees. So they're going to get a $3.5 trillion. Their ages right now, between the ages of 48 and 68 years of age. Now, the people garden and landscape more when they're 68 or less. They do less of it themselves, and they do what? They buy more landscape services. So I'm very bullish on the landscape services sector over the next decade and a half. So that $7 trillion, $3.5 trillion is going to go to boomers. They're aging, going to do less of it themselves. So in my mind, I'm thinking that equates to a whole lot of outdoor living spaces. That's a whole lot of outdoor kitchens. That's a whole lot of flower shrubs and trees that those folks are going to be buying over the next decade and a half. So you got trends and you got counter trends. So I've been often referred to as Professor Silver Lining, because I always see the silver lining in the midst of even the economic downturns. Fortunately, there's some longer-term trends that I think are very favorable for the industry. And one of those is biophilic design. And there's a concept called biophilia. We know it as horticulturists, that people inherently feel more better in the midst of plants than they do in other man-made structures. And biophilic design is one of the hottest fields within the architectural industry now. And they're incorporating the biology of plants into the architectural designs in which they are coming up with. And we can see, even in these pictures, as I scroll through them, you can see elements of water and plants and green walls and natural lighting being used. So if we were to go into the time machine and travel into the future 100 years from now, we would probably see rooms like this. Instead of blue dogs being everywhere, we would see green walls everywhere. Because we know that those green walls scrub the volatile organic compounds out of the air, that the carpet and the paint and the ceiling structures and so forth are giving off. So they're scrubbing the air, making it cleaner and healthier to breathe. So we will have by then recognized these things and incorporated much of that into our architectural designs, so that we see a lot of green roofs. And by the time we fly over cities 100 years from now, you'll barely be able to see the city because every roof will be covered with some sort of green material 100 years from now. And then all of our green infrastructure projects that we will build into our cities, because we will recognize that putting in redundant gray infrastructure, redundant piping to handle stormwater runoff is not the most economically feasible alternative. But green infrastructure can save you lots of dollars, like the city of Philadelphia saving $700 million a year because of the green infrastructure projects that they put in relative to redundant stormwater piping. So by then, we will have recognized these benefits. And we will have monetized the landscape. Here is a NRDC report in which they have you take a typical office building. It's only, I think, 18,000 square feet in terms of its dimensions. You put a green roof on it, and you have bioswales and permeable pavement, and you plant trees in the right places and so forth and so on. And all of a sudden, if you account for the ecosystem services and the health and well-being benefits and the economic benefits associated with all the green that went in around this office building over a 60-year time period, and Duane, you use a net present value analysis and you bring it back to today's dollars, all of a sudden that landscape and those amenities become a $1.8 million landscape. Now, when's the last time, Mike, you saw a $1.8 million landscape being put in? There aren't many, but that's the value of that landscape in real dollars in terms of the benefits, not the pretty benefits, but the economic, the ecosystem services, and the health and well-being benefits. You see, we need to establish that relevancy. When we demonstrate to folks that memory retention is enhanced by as much as 20% in the presence of plants, right? Hopefully you've learned one or two things this morning, but think about what you could have learned and remembered if we'd had plants all over the place. Well, we didn't have our token plant right here, right? When we demonstrate that a kid with ADHD taking a 20-minute stroll through a landscaped area, that 20-minute stroll has the same neurological effect as two of their medications, that's relevancy. That speaks to every mom with an ADD kid across America. Those are the messages that our horticultural businesses should be claiming from the mountaintops. Those are the end results that we should be envisioning in our breeding programs, in our cultural practices improvements, in all the things that we do as horticultural professionals. Those are the end game, and that will create more of an inelastic demand. Because we know in inelastic demand, when you raise your price, even if you sold fewer units, when you raise your price, total revenue will go up in an inelastic demand. So the real magic question, Charlie, is how do we make demand more inelastic? And it's by emphasizing those other benefits, the economic benefits, ecosystem services, and the health and well-being benefits. So we've talked about some big-time challenges, right? And the key question is are we positioned to help address these cross-cutting challenges? Undoubtedly. Right? Undoubtedly. The level of expertise in this room, and we've seen at this conference and so forth, we have many of the answers, not just to the horticultural industry's issues and these challenges, we have many of the answers to societal issues and challenges. And we just need to tell people in a much more better fashion. Thank you all very much.
It is really hard to follow that. I wish I could just say, thank you all for coming. Enjoy the rest of your conference. But I have one more agenda item to cover at this meeting. Thank you very much, Charlie. That was truly inspiring. And I think we're all going to go out there and sell to our constituents the way to approach the green industry and get those ecosystem services, those economic benefits out there. What I'd like to do next is acknowledge the Extension Communication Awards, and I can pretty much guarantee that not everyone's name that I'm going to be reading off is here. We have three books that received awards. We have two leaflets that received awards. We have a blog, a video, and a website. So what I'd like to do is read off the names, and if there is, and those of you who have received these awards, feel free to come up and I'll give you the awards. If there's just one of the authors, you could come up and take the awards for the rest of the folks. But I want to acknowledge everybody. So the first outstanding book was Grow to Learn, A Practical Guide for Successful School Gardens in Florida. And authors were Danielle Treadwell, our authors are, Sydney Park Brown, Kelly Brew, Anna Prizia, and Katie Ladd. So congratulations. Do you want to take all of them? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. The next outstanding book was the California Master Gardener Handbook, second edition, and it has 25 authors. Dennis Pittenger, Pamela Giselle, Ben Faber, James Walworth, Deborah Giroud, Deborah Silva, Janet Harton, Demetrius Kontaxis, Richard Molinar, Julie Newman, Ralph Gay, M. Ali Haravandi, Donald Hodel, Nancy Garrison, Paul Vossen, Delbert Farnham, Mark Balda, Donald Murhot, Carol Lovett, Mikhail Rose, Georgios Vidalakis, Bertold Berg, Akif Eskelin, John Karlick, and Judith Aesop. Are any of those Californians here?
I'm from UC. They're my colleagues.
Okay. Sure. Yes, that would be wonderful. Thanks. We will clap for you in their absence. Thank you. And the third outstanding book is IPM for Shrubs in the Southeastern U.S., Nursery Production, Volume 1. And this book was written by Sarah White, William Klingeman, Christine Brahman, Matthew Chappelle, Juan Horg Chong, Jeffrey Durr, Winston Dunwell, Amy Fulcher, Frank Hale, Gary Knox, Anthony Laboud, Matthews Parrett, Joseph Neal, Nicole Gauthier, Jean Williams Woodard, and Alan Windham. Are any of those folks here? Great. Okay, one of the outstanding leaflets was Growing Microgreens for the Mississippi Gardener. Authors are Gary Bachman, Beth Barron, and Karen Page. And I see Gary back there. The second outstanding leaflet was Spotted Wing Drosophila by Raymond Cloyd and Sherry Copeland. This is out of Kansas State University. We'll get that to them. Now, an outstanding blog, Mississippi Fruit and Nut Blog, Eric Staffney. An outstanding video, Budding, Grafting, and Planting Walnuts in the Field, Rachel Elkins, Carolyn DeBuse, and Ray Lucas. And finally, our outstanding website, the Georgia Certified Landscape Professional Webinar Series, Bodhi Panisi and Todd Hurt from the University of Georgia. Okay, thanks. All right, well, unless there is any other business, I think that concludes our Extension Industry Breakfast. Thank you all for coming, and gives you a little bit of time before you have to head to your next meeting here at ASHS. So thank you. Thanks to our speakers once again. They were wonderful.